We've begun our study of wisdom literature, taking a look at some of the key ways in which Hebrew poetry expresses ideas, and also a thorough look at the book of Job. Probably the most popular expression of wisdom literature is found in the Psalms. The Psalms are dear to the hearts of many around the world, and so many have been memorized and used in a variety of settings. Today we're going to take a closer look at the Psalms, first of all going through an overview of what the Psalms are all about. The Psalms are 150 poems. Originally, they were meant to be sung, and you can see that in a variety of ways in the titles to the Psalms, where there are instructions regarding the performance of these, or what tunes to use, or the manner in which the instrumentation is to take place. Now, there are more Psalms than just those that we find in the 150 of the Psalter in the Old Testament. There are some Psalms that have been found among the Dead Sea Scrolls. They're in addition to the ones that we have found, have had for years and, of course, centuries in the Psalms. And there are even some Psalms that we can find in other places of the Bible. For instance, there are some Psalms of David found in the books of Samuel and Kings and Chronicles, notes and expressions of poetry and worship songs that are listed there. There are even some in other parts of the wisdom literature. Some of the writings of in Job can be considered psalms, and some of the expressions in Ecclesiastes might well be considered psalms. But that doesn't make any difference with regard to the Psalms that we have in the 150 that are collected into the Psalter of the Old Testament. This is the collection that's been used for worship throughout Israel's history, the history of the Jews, and also the history of the Christian church. And the collection as it's been received, the way we have it today, has been stable since the first century AD, since the time of Jesus. Now, the Psalms themselves are divided into five books. We're not entirely sure why that's the case, but it is clear that it is the case. Psalms 1 through 41 form the first book. Psalms 42 through 72 form the second book. Psalms 73 through 89 form the third book. Psalms 90 through 106 form the fourth book. And then Psalms 107 through 150 form the last or the fifth book. Each of these collections ends with a doxology, and that's very important to think about, especially when we look at Psalm 89, because Psalm 89 is a psalm at the end of the third book, but it's a very somber psalm. It's written in response to the death of a king too young. He was too young to have died. Something must have happened, either a disease or battle or something like that. And so the whole psalm reflects this somberness. And then suddenly at the last part, we have this note, praise the Lord. Well, we should understand that the note, praise the Lord, is not really part of Psalm 89, but it's the end of the collection. It's the end of the book, the third book. And each of the books ends with a similar kind of doxology, so pay attention to that. Of course, the doxology in the final book, the fifth book, is actually Psalm 150, which is the most expressive song of praise of them all. Doxology simply means a song of praise, and of course, all of the praise is to God. Most of the Psalms of David occur early in the Psalter, and most of them are in the first collection. And that may reflect the manner in which the Psalms came together and were formed and shaped. If you think through the history of Christianity and the changing styles of music and the development or growth or writing of new songs, something of the same seems to have been taking place in the Psalms. That maybe the Psalms began with a small collection of David's songs, and to these later were added other songs as they became popular or were written. And so we have the sense of development through the Psalms. There are also some collections, for instance, the Psalms of Asaph and the Sons of Korah, those Psalms that are given that by the title, occur somewhere in the middle, which would make sense because they were born long after David, and became chief musicians or worship leaders in the time of the temple. So there's a sense in which the progression of the Psalms, as we have them in the book of Psalms, seems to reflect at least in part some of the historical development of the songs themselves. There's even a psalm that occurs late in Israel's history, found late in the collection. I'm thinking of Psalm 137, which is a song written by the exiles in Babylon after the temple has been destroyed during the transition time between the first and second temple periods. Most of the psalms were likely to have been written by that time, but here's a psalm that was written very late, and it occurs quite late in the psalms collection as well, Psalm 137, just 13 from the end of the book. There are also other collections. For instance, the Psalms of Ascent, or Pilgrim Psalms, occur in the last section, and these were likely a separated collection of songs that were used by pilgrims who were going up to the three great pilgrim festivals in Jerusalem, three times a year during three of the festivals. All of the Israelites from all over the land were invited or encouraged or expected to go up to Jerusalem, and this was sort of like a collection of songs to sing along the way. There are a number of psalms that have titles. The titles aren't really considered part of the psalms themselves. They may or may not reflect the original circumstances. There's some very interesting ones. We don't know positively that the psalms were necessarily collected or written in those contexts, but there are some very interesting things that we learn. For instance, Psalm 3 is called a Psalm of David when he fled from his son Absalom. This would have been when his son Absalom tried to take over the kingdom, and there's certainly some notes of concern and expressions of frustration in Psalm 3 that reflect such circumstances. Psalm 18 is a psalm of David, the servant of the Lord, who addressed the words of the song to the Lord on the day when the Lord delivered him from the hand of all of his enemies and the hand of Saul. This would be the pre-King David, during the times he was running from Saul, who was seeking to take his life. Psalm 34 is called a Psalm of David when he feigned madness before Abimelech so that he drove him out and he went away. Now, we actually read that story in the book of Samuel. We read about a time when David was living among the Philistines, and Abimelech was trying to go to war against Saul, and David didn't want to go to war against Saul because he believed that Saul was the Lord's anointed. And so he actually feigned madness in order not to have to participate in this and to get away from circumstances. There's a powerful psalm, Psalm 51, that's called the Psalm of David, when the prophet Nathan came to him after he had gone into Bathsheba. Of course, that's when he committed adultery with Bathsheba, and the psalm is certainly a penitential psalm, a psalm that reflects the idea of seeking forgiveness for having done a great wrong. And it's a powerful and beautiful psalm, made even more powerful and beautiful when we connect it to that incident in David's own life. And Psalm 52 is called a maskil of David when Doeg the Edomite came to Saul and said to him, David has come to the house of Ahimelech. So there are a variety of ways in which the psalms actually reflect or have the possibility of reflecting some real life situations. Now, that's not true of most of the Psalms, but it is true of a number of the Psalms. Sometimes the titles appear to be dedications, or they indicate those to whom these Psalms are written or in whose honor they are intended. Many of them are to the leader. Who is the leader? It may well mean to the leader of the people. It may even refer to God as leader of the people. But more than likely, these were songs that were originally created in the context of Israel's worship and were devoted to the one who was the chief musician or worship leader in the tabernacle first and later on in the temple. We're not quite certain about those things, but we have quite a few that are to the leader. There's even one to a person called Jeduthun, and we don't know who Jeduthun is, but obviously he was an important person, and the dedication is made to him. There are some titles that appear to give instructions about tunes or performance cues. Of course, we don't have a full understanding of this because some of these performance cues or tunes seem are tunes that we don't know. They were probably quite popular in the days of ancient Israel. We think of, for instance, Psalm 22 is supposed to be according to the deer of the dawn. Probably a wonderful lilting melody, or in Psalm 22's case, maybe even a dirge, because the first two-thirds of it are pretty negative, and the pain that David is experiencing as people torment him. I think some of the others might have more dancing-like characters. According to the Lilies, two psalms, actually, 45 and 69, maybe both to the same tune. According to Alamoth, 46. According to the Lilies of the Covenant, 60 and possibly 80. There are different instructions with regard to what tunes to use for these words. In Hebrew also, there's a slight differentiation between two words that are very much similar. They look alike when you see them, except for the placement of the pronunciation dot above one of the letters. There's seer and there's shir. A seer is a song without instrumental accompaniment, and their shir is a psalm which is with instrumental accompaniment. In other words, songs were intended to be sung as solos, or not necessarily solos, but unaccompanied, a cappella. And shir psalms were intended to be psalms to songs that had lots or at least some accompaniment, musical instruments going along with that. There are other things we find in the instructions found in the titles, maskil and maktim, or miktam, two words that we're not entirely certain what the meaning is, but they're found in a number of the Psalms. We do know that miktam seems to occur in Psalms where David is in a situation of dire distress. So it may be something like a kind of foreboding note about the Psalm. We have a couple of other hints at things with stringed instruments or for the memorial offering, or even a psalm that's two psalms that are written and dedicated according to the Gittith, and we don't really know what the Gittith is all about. There are a number of titles that identify the author or the presumed author, and again, most of those are David. If we have 150 Psalms, David is attributed with at least 73 of them. And of course, as I said earlier most of those Psalms are toward the beginning of the Psalter. In other words, likely to be the original, or at least part of the original collection that was forming what we know as Book One. There are two that are attributed to Solomon, Psalm 72 and 127. Interestingly, both of those are related to themes associated with royalty and the rule or reign of kings. A lot of the sons, Psalms are to the sons of Korah, 12 of them, which is a high percentage, as well as Asaph, another 12 of them. And in each case, those collections are right around the middle of the Psalter. There are two very interesting psalms, one attributed to Heman the Ezrahite and another to Ethan the Ezrahite. Now, if this Ezra designation is the Ezra that we have as part of the leadership following the return of the exiles from Babylon to Jerusalem once again, these would make the psalms quite late in Israel's existence. And in fact, both the psalms are quite dark in tone. Certainly the one, 88, attributed to Heman the Ezrahite. The one to Ethan the Ezrahite, that becomes a bit of a problem because the psalm reflects on the death, the young death of a king. And there were no kings during the time of Ezra, precisely because the kings had been carried away, and the line of David, although it still existed in the genealogical records from family to family, the line of David was no longer allowed to rule because now the Persians were ruling. Interestingly, there's also one Psalm of Moses. It's Psalm 90, a very powerful psalm, one that's sung quite often, O God, our help in ages past. That's attributed to Moses, so it might have been a praise song that Moses carried along the way and maybe used as his own devotional activities and then passed along to others, and it became part of the collection of the Psalms that we have as the permanent collection of songs. Most of the Psalms of David, as I said before, occur early in the Psalter. Most praise Psalms occur late in the Psalter. And then there's that collection, Psalms 120 through 134, the Songs of Ascent, that appear to have been a separated collection at one time that was used by those who were traveling up to Jerusalem for one of the three pilgrim festivals each year. They begin at a distance from Jerusalem, Psalm 120, and in distress. They move into songs which anticipate seeing Jerusalem, 122, 125, 132. They speak of traveling, 121 and 126, and they end in worship at the temple, 134. So there's this wonderful collection of those who are traveling, anticipating coming to Jerusalem, building in excitement, and trusting God for safety along the way. We should also mention the idea of acrostics. An acrostic is a poem in which the first letter of each successive section is the letter of each successive letter of the Hebrew alphabet, from Aleph all the way to the end of the Hebrew alphabet, Tau. There's a sense in which we might say this is an attempt to show things about a particular topic from A to Z. Most expressive in this manner, a psalm that obviously took a long time to create and to form, is Psalm 119. In this case, there are eight parallel couplets, two lines, you know, synonymous parallelism, usually sometimes antithetic parallelism. And the first letter of each of eight couplets begins with a letter of the Hebrew alphabet. In the first case, the first eight begin with Aleph, the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet. And then the second grouping of eight begin with the letter Beit, the second letter of the Hebrew alphabet. In fact, that's where we get our term alphabet from, the languages which emerge out of the Middle East, including Hebrew. And then the third grouping of eight couplets begins each time with the letter Gimel, which is the third letter in the Hebrew alphabet, all the way to Tau. Now, what's going on here, if you read Psalm 119, in our English Bibles, we have it as 176 verses. Well, there are 22 verses in the Hebrew alphabet, and if you have each verse representing one of the couplets, two lines of parallelism of some kind, what you have is 22 letters times eight couplets for each letter of the Hebrew alphabet, resulting in 176 verses. It's really a very well-structured psalm, which doesn't necessarily come across in our English language or any other language. But if you look in your Bibles, there's a good chance that each grouping of eight verses will be preceded by a letter of the Hebrew alphabet, and that's the reason for that. And that's what we call an acrostic, where the successive sections, sometimes as short as just a line or two, begin with successive letters of the Hebrew alphabet. In this case, it's very well developed so that you have actually eight groupings of couplets for each successive letter of the Hebrew alphabet. Again, as I had mentioned before when we looked at Job and got our introduction to the wisdom literature, the most obvious literary device in all of Hebrew poetry is that of parallelism. And parallelism occurs in two major forms, synonymous, where two or more lines say the same thing using different words, like Psalm 88, verse 3, "My soul is full of troubles, my life draws near to Sheol." Sheol means death. Or Psalm 78, verse 5, "He established a decree in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel." There are a number of antithetic parallelism expressions, two lines that declare opposite ideas in order to support the same conclusion. "I hate you double-minded, but I love your law," Psalm 119, verse 113. Or Psalm 78, verse 50, "He did not spare them from death, but gave their lives over to the plague." Two opposite ideas that then, in turn, build a single theme. And not as frequent, but still quite prominent in all of the poetry of Hebrew, of the wisdom literature, is the parallelism of stair-like, where an idea begins to develop into other thoughts along the way. For instance, in Psalm 103, Bless the Lord, O my soul, and do not forget all his benefits, who forgives all your iniquity, who heals all your diseases, who redeems your life from the pit, who crowns you with steadfast love and mercy, who satisfies you with good things as long as you live, so that your youth is renewed like the eagles. And you can see the building there. As I mentioned another time, there are literary devices in Hebrew, very important in Hebrew, that don't translate well into our other languages. Rhyme and meter, kind of a cadence for recitation. Assonance, the repetition of vowel sounds, or consonants, the repetition of consonant sounds, or alliteration, the repetition of word beginning letters or sounds. Then there are some subtle and complex literary devices like enveloping, where the beginning and ending of a psalm has the same refrain. Psalm 118 is a good example where, "O give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. His steadfast love endures forever," occurs at the beginning and the ending of the psalm, sort of like an envelope into which the rest of the psalm is tucked, meaning that idea, but explaining it more fully. There's also chiasm, which is more complex. It's a reflective repetition of lines or phrases or ideas in clear parallelism. And one of the examples of that I could bring to your attention is Psalm 114, where the first two verses and the last two verses echo one another, and then the interior verses, 3 and 4 and 5 and 6, reflect one another in some reverse way. We'll have a chance to talk about this kind of chiasm in other places, but take a look at this and you'll begin to understand what's going on there. There's more about this in my book, Covenant Documents, Reading the Bible Again for the First Time. If we understand and use the Psalms correctly, we can see that there are a variety of different forms or meanings to the Psalms. My own categorization of the Psalms includes at least 8 different kinds. Individual laments, which are cries of individuals in times of distress. Communal laments, which are similar, but now cries of the whole community. Hymns of praise, which celebrate God's goodness and character. Songs of confidence, which express confidence or trust in God during difficult times. Royal psalms, which express praise to Yahweh as the true king and also praise the monarch who rules on Yahweh's behalf. Psalms of Zion, which are sort of like national anthems. Thanks psalms, expressing specifically thanks to God, using the word todah in Hebrew, and then wisdom or priestly instruction psalms, which are actually tools for passing along wisdom from one generation to the next. We'll be exploring each of those in series in the next sessions. But if you'd like more on these things, check out my book on the Psalms, Hear Me, O God, Meditations on All 150 Psalms, or more for the background, Covenant Documents, Reading the Bible Again for the First Time.